Today's Teisho will be on Case 60 in the Pienu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 60 is entitled Umon's Staff Becomes a Dragon. Engo's Introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not, by nature, different. Mountains, rivers, and your own self are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well versed in Zen koans? See the following. Main subject. Umon held out his staff and said to the assembled monks and nuns, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. Where are the mountains, rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. The ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you really hear me? Only be carefree. Stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice this morning on this beautiful autumn Saturday morning. It's been, probably for many people here, it's been a fairly ordinary week. But for some people, it's been an extraordinary week. You probably were following the situation in the money markets this week, or you might have been following the situation in the money markets this week. But basically, people were saying that the American financial system could be on the brink of collapse. And I noticed when I went online that a number of major, over the last, say, 3 or 4 weeks, a number of major brokerage houses, a number of major investment houses like Lehman Brothers went down in flames, and a number of major banks have gone into a state of crisis and have had to be assisted by the federal government. People were calling it a meltdown of the economic system. And people were quite worried. Apparently it started to spill over into the European economy and into the Asian economy. And it could be, you know, very, very serious. This could turn out to be quite significant. Thousands and thousands of people have lost their jobs on Wall Street. Something like 60,000 people. And we lost something like 150,000 jobs, I guess, this month. So all of this could be seen as a kind of crisis situation. Most people, I don't think anybody here works in the stock market. But if you had worked in the stock market and you came to sit today, this would be like a life preserver for you. But even so, even if it's not the case that even if it's true that you don't work in the stock market, you know, we could be on the edge of quite an interesting period of time. My grandfather was a young adult just getting out of college in the year 1929. Now, most people don't really know much about that year, but in the 1920s, the 1920s were just like the 2000 decade and the 90s in our time. People were investing a lot of money in the stock market, and the economy was growing very, very fast. And all kinds of new inventions had arrived on the scene. So, you know, I myself don't know how to use an iPod. In fact, if you put one on a table with some other items, I couldn't find it. I don't really know how to use one. And I guess there's other devices too. Somebody was telling me about a device called a Wii. Again, I know Wii is yes in French, but I couldn't find a Wii if you showed it to me, you know. Only a few years ago, I got a mobile phone. At one time, somebody lent me a mobile phone, and then I tried to use it, but I suddenly realized I didn't even know how to open it. But the interesting thing is that you know, people are producing all these new products, and a lot of the economy depends on that. Well, it was true in the 1920s too. They had a new device that became very widespread in the United States. It was called the telephone, right? And the telephone was a new technology at the time, and they had other new technologies too. Radio. Commercial radio really took off for the first time. And during that period also, the automobile, the car, was getting off the ground. So there was all this new technology, and the economy was just growing. And my grandfather was like lots of young people at that time, expecting like a life of prosperity and abundance, you know. And he studied to be an engineer, believe it or not. He was just a young adult, and in 1929, the American financial system completely fell apart for reasons that are very similar to what's happened now. People were investing on the stock market, and in order to invest on the stock market, they were borrowing huge sums of, sounds familiar, borrowing huge sums of money. So basically, people were in debt for huge sums, and they borrowed large amounts because they believed that the profits on the stock market would protect them, that the stock market would just keep growing. So it was okay to borrow more than you had, because basically your stocks would keep growing, and you'd make so much profit you could pay off your loan. See, and this was how people thought, just like now. You know. The stock market went through a crisis of debt, actually, and suddenly the stock values started dropping because they were not based upon anything substantial. And as the stock market plunged, people suddenly had to pay back their debts, but they couldn't pay back their debts because they were banking on profits, see, that didn't materialize. And then the economy collapsed. And something like one out of every three adult Americans was out of work, 30% unemployment, maybe higher. And this went on for more than a decade. So my grandfather never got to work as an engineer. He worked as a in a factory, and he worked as a mechanic. He spent most of his life repairing cars because the economy was in such bad shape during the major years of his life. Now, you know, I'm not trying to scare you about the future, although what I'm saying sounds very scary. Because same thing is happening, has happened right now, maybe not to the same extreme, but, you know, I get home very late at night, I sometimes sit down, and my wife comes home very late at night also. And she is exhausted from working, and she'll flip on the television. And I'll come home from sitting, from meditation, and I'll sit down and have dates and almonds or something, a little snack before I go to bed. And my wife, one of her favorite shows is called, I can't remember the name of the house, but it's the name of the show, but it's about flipping houses, what's called flipping houses. So it's about people who buy a house for like $150,000, and then they put in like $20,000, and then they sell it for $250,000, right? And the show is like, it's like happy, you know? It's like, how can we get this house up to $250,000? You know, well, instead of painting this wall white, we'll paint it yellow, you know? And then we'll put some new lights on the front of the house, you know? And some new tiles in the bathroom, you know? So basically, they take a house that was $150,000, they do a little bit of work on it, and then they sell it for this wildly increased amount. And everybody's trying to flip his house like this. Well, this has driven the price of housing way up, right? And at some point, people realize, you know, these houses aren't worth that much. And what we're seeing now is that everybody was borrowing huge amounts to get a more and more expensive house, hoping that the values would keep growing, but they stopped growing. And now everybody's caught short with a huge amount of debt. It's just like in 1929. Well, you know, when these events happen, they can be really catastrophic, you know? It can be really, you know, I hope it doesn't turn out to be like 1929 again, because a whole generation of Americans sort of lost their opportunities, you know? They were planning on being all kinds of things, and mostly they spent the so-called best years of their lives, the years in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, struggling to survive, you know, basically. And it was a tragedy, you know. But, you know, when events like this happen, it should be sort of like a message or a warning to people, you know. You know, we live in a kind of collective dream. We do. It's like a collective dream. And everybody so pretty much goes along with everybody else. You say, well, what are the people who, you know, he seems to know what he's doing. What's he doing? You know, and he's flipping his house. You know, well, if he's flipping his house, he seems to know it. I'll try to flip my house. You know, this is how people are. This is how humans are. So back in the 1920s, everybody was investing in the stock market and borrowing huge amounts of money. If you were, even if you didn't know anything about the stock market, you were borrowing money and just buying stocks. People would give each other tips. You know, you'd go to the grocery store and you'd meet somebody in line, and they'd say, you know, have you heard of this new company, Brush Beryllium? No. Well, you should get some stock. Really? Oh, I hear it's going through the roof. You know, people would go buy stock just like that, you know. And people flip houses now, you know, flipping houses. One day the house was worth $150,000. Next day, $250,000, thanks to Sears Paints, you know. Well, that doesn't really happen. That's a fantasy, right? But people live out a collective fantasy. I'm going to be wildly rich if I repaint my house. You know, I'll be, literally, like, millions of people buy into these fantasies, right? We sort of go along with this collective dream for a long time. Sometimes people can live their whole lives in a collective dream, and in the collective dream, you know. Yet, you know, when something like this happens, it's like the whole society sort of goes off a cliff. You have to stop and say, you know, maybe our society isn't as wise or as mature or as intelligent as everybody thinks it is, you know. This week, you know, the best and the brightest, well, over the last, say, couple of months, the best and the brightest people in America, economists, financiers, and so on, have shown very clearly that they don't know how to solve this problem. They really don't. They don't have a clue. Congress passed a bill this week, which is designed to help the situation. But even though the amount of money was very large, they decided to set aside $700 billion. The actual amount of debt caused by the housing market is trillions of dollars. Trillions. So this is like the whole society has lived in this dream state until it gets on the edge of a cliff, and maybe we're dropping off the edge of a cliff right now. Maybe we won't drop off. But, you know, sooner or later we're going to drop off, because that's the way humans live, you know, in a kind of collective fantasy. And it doesn't, most people are happy to live in the fantasy until suddenly something happens and it, like, the curtains are pulled over, open. The curtains are pulled open and you see that this is like a madhouse. It's not orderly. It's not rational. It's crazy. You know, it's built on a lot of unsound thinking, a lot of wishful thinking, a lot of fantasy, a lot of fear, irrational fear. And you can see this in other times too, you know. A whole culture will go off the cliff, you know. It might happen to you on a more personal level, you know. Maybe you're you have a parent who's told you you need to become, you know, doctor, right? You need to be a doctor. And maybe you go to medical school and you get to be a doctor. You know? I was reading the other day that a very large number of doctors are very unhappy with their lives, with their professional lives in particular. That, you know, I can think of all, I mean, my own mother loved me very much, and because I was good in school, she wanted me to be a doctor, because she imagined that if I were a doctor, I would have no suffering in my life, you know. I'd make huge amounts of money, and everybody would admire me, right? And I could do whatever I wanted, and so on and so on. She didn't really know any doctors, but she watched doctors on television shows, you know. And when I was growing up, there were two very handsome doctors. One was a doctor named Ben Casey. My mother would never miss Ben Casey. And he was a very handsome, hunky doctor. And he would have to make decisions about life and death every week. And the other was another show, also handsome doctor, Dr. Kildare, starring Richard Chamberlain. And also, he was very handsome and would have to make life and death. My mother just thought these doctors walked to the earth like gods, you know. So she wanted me to be a doctor. Fortunately, I didn't become one. But apparently, a lot of people's mothers wanted them to be doctors. And they became doctors, and something like 60-some percent of them, very unhappy, you know. And this is like a little crisis, right? Right now, the society's in a big crisis. But this is like a little crisis. It's like all your life you're told, if you become a doctor, you're going to be totally happy, and everything pretty much is going to go your way. And then you become a doctor, after all this work, you become a doctor, and suddenly you realize, I really hate my job. How did this happen? See? Well, I think that basically people live in a kind of collective dream. Everybody looks to everybody else for how to live. Yeah. And sometimes it works out all right, but generally speaking, I think we're always skating on thin ice. You know, people are always amazed. I have people, I run into people socially, and sometimes they know that I am involved with Zen. And they'll ask me a little bit about it, sort of curiously. In fact, I just went out to dinner on Thursday night with somebody who had heard about this and was a little bit curious about meditation and wanted to learn about it. And they weren't curious enough probably to really try it, but they were intrigued by it. And anyway, this woman was enjoying hearing about meditation, and then I finally said, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I get up every morning and sit. I get up every morning and meditate. And she said, really? You know, what time do you get up? And I said, well, 4:30 or 5 o'clock. And I said, I do like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours every day. And then I could see that she began to, when I tell people this, they begin to back off a little bit. You know, it's like they realize I'm not normal. You know, this happens. This has happened to me all my life. It's like all of a sudden they begin to think, wait a minute, this is not right. You know, you're not supposed to get up and do 2 hours of meditation every day. Now, if I had said to her, you know, I get up every day at 4:30 and I get online and I start playing, I start investing online, she'd think, oh my God, that's wonderful, right? Yeah. But if you say, I get up every day and I meditate, see, that this is not normal, right? I mean, she didn't have contempt for me or something, but I could see that she was beginning to wonder about me just a little bit. Maybe it was my imagination, but I don't think so. And if you tell people, you know, if you have friends who know what you do, if you come here and you sit 3 times a week, you know, your friends are going to start thinking, well, that's a little odd, you know. If you went to the movies 3 times a week, nobody would think it was strange, right? But maybe they'd say, well, he's really into movies, right? And if you watch TV every night, you would just be like millions of other Americans, you know. So my point is that that we live in a kind of collective dream, and that it's not necessarily easy to step out of it. And also, you know, people take their cues from everybody else, and the assumption is that the society is a sane society. It's basically a functional society. And then something like what we've just seen this week happens, where we realize that basically millions and millions of people have bought into a system that was unsound. And, you know, actually, many people could see that it's unsound, you know, really. I mean, there have been warning signs about this for at least 10 years. People have been writing books and saying the economy is it's not based on anything real, the housing values are inflated, this is going to collapse. But basically, nobody listened. When I was coming to the sit this morning, one of the shows I like to listen to on the radio is called Living on Earth. I don't know if you've ever heard it, but if you have a chance, if you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you can hear it, you know. And it's an ecological program that's put out by PRI or NPR. And they were talking about the amount of chemicals we release into the water system. And they were talking about the fact that we still release very serious industrial chemicals into the water system. We have some laws on the books, but not everywhere. And also we do things like this. You know, if you have antibiotics that you haven't used, you might take them out of the cabinet and flush them down the toilet. This is very common. And in fact, if you the instructions on some bottles actually used to say, empty these in down the drain if you don't if you want to dispose of them. You might empty your old antibiotics down the drain, you might have like some paint thinner. You might think, what am I going to do with this paint? You might dump it down the drain. Well, if you multiply that by 300 million, we're putting huge amounts of some toxic chemicals in the water, and also huge amounts of antibiotics and other kinds of medicines. Even anti-cancer drugs get flushed down the drain and wind up in the water system. Well, this is just like one little slice of our society. Now, anybody can see that this is like unsustainable, right? That if you keep doing this, eventually it will not be possible for like aquatic life to continue. Right? It's just that simple. If it's one little step at a time, anybody can see it coming, right? But we don't change because we live in this collective reality. So it's fascinating how, like, even little children understand these things. You could have understood this when you were 10 years old. And it seems obvious to little children that this is a crazy world. In fact, I think that when people are about 12 or 13, they begin to realize that the society we live in is really not a sane society, not really necessarily everything it's supposed to be, everything it imagines that it is. And I think one of the reasons teenagers have such a hard time is because part of them is still very naive and very unfamiliar with the world, and when they begin to play the games that adult Americans or adult human beings play, they begin to realize this is really not right. And I think they have a lot of struggles because they're trying to fit in, they're asked to fit in, or they're expected to fit in. And yet a part of them is saying, this is really ridiculous. This is really not a sound way to live. So usually, as I say, people get into the dream and they stay in the dream. Every once in a while there's some kind of a cataclysm that makes them realize maybe that this is a dream. And maybe sometimes in your own life you have some event that forces you sometimes to see that this so-called reality is not real. My feeling is that Zen is a different way of dealing with life. Really basically different. It's not founded on the idea that you should do what other people do or believe. You shouldn't look to other people for decisions about what is real and what is not. I think Zen is really like very different, kind of unique enterprise, if you want to put it that way. Because, as I say, most people just try to get into the collective reality as fast as they can and to stay there and not worry about it, And unless there's a catastrophe, people try to... It's like you want to wrap yourself in this dream because it promises you that you will be happy if you do. My feeling is that Zen is really like a different way to live, And it's here's how let me say a little bit about how it works. But when people begin to meditate, they have assumptions about what meditation is or isn't. And the first thing we do is teach people to sit on the cushion and watch your breath. And this is like, even though this seems so trivial, you know, this is like re-education of the whole human being. Because I think people learn how to live in a kind of fantasy realm. And we're very much indoctrinated into that fantasy on every level, even down to the level of like our bodies, you know. So people become almost like addicted to modern society, to our society. It's well known, for example, that people have very serious problems with overeating in the United States. I was reading the other day that something like 30% of all Americans are actually obese. This is not just overweight, but like obese. And large numbers of children now are seriously overweight, you know, and it's a big health problem. Now, you know, this is not like the result of individual people making decisions. It's a whole culture that produces this. It teaches you how to be a human being, what to do with your body, and it produces like appetites and desires, you know. So little kids early on are trained, really, or conditioned to like very high-fat foods and lots of carbohydrates and so on and so on. And they are discouraged, really, almost from getting much exercise. You know, if you're a good consumer, you might spend a lot of time eating high carbohydrate foods and sitting in front of television or increasingly a computer. And athletics, getting exercise or something, might not be part of the way you live. You know, and this isn't an accident. This is how we socialize people into life in the modern world. So when you sit down on the cushion, this is like starting all over again. You know, this is like, I think this is deconditioning body, mind, and heart. You know, it's not easy to meditate, just physically. You sit down on a cushion, and you know, one of the things people sometimes ask me is, don't we have like a backrest? You know, don't we have a backrest? And you will go to some places where they have meditation classes where they have like these little chairs with no legs, and you can sit on them and they'll hold your back up. I say, but we don't have a backrest. We sit on the cushion, and I tell everybody, pull your hips forward and your shoulders back and lean into the cushion. And this is like a huge strain for beginners. Last night we had a bunch of beginners, and you could see them struggling, you know, and you could think, well, why don't we sit in a chair? You know, and if you've injured yourself, that please sit in a chair. This is, but why doesn't everybody, why don't we get some of those cushions with backrests, see? But what we're really trying to do is re-educate the body. This is like simple deconditioning, right? This is like, in my opinion, returning to the natural body, right? Even the way we sit is unhealthy, you know. You slumped over in a chair, hips back, shoulders forward. You depress your internal organs. And this is, even chairs are even designed to encourage you to sit that way. So we sit on the cushion, and we straighten the back, and we bring the hips forward and the shoulders back. And now the spine is straight, you know. And the body is like a system. It's a living system. And when you sit this way, you stimulate certain nerves. Other nerves relax. You know, and from ancient times in India and China, people have known that if you keep the spine straight, it's easier to be calm and alert. You know, and then you work with your Manipura chakra, your Dantian, your Hara. You breathe through the abdominal region, which people almost never do. And this is like re-educating the body, or I would say deconditioning the body. And, you know, it's very challenging at first, but eventually, you know, you'll be sitting on the cushion, and this will happen to you sooner or later. And if you've been meditating for a year or two, I'm sure it's already happened. Sometimes you get up, and it's like every atom in your body feels like it's cleansed or refreshed. It doesn't always happen, but sometimes it happens, you know. We have a sitting group up in Blairstown on Sunday morning at 7 o'clock, and two new people came, and they were in their 20s, I guess, early 20s, mid 20s, and they had never done meditation before, but we do three sits up there, three periods of meditation with walking in between, so it's a lot for beginners. Instead of just two, there's like a third one, and each of these is like half an hour. So it's a little bit more sitting than we do here on a Monday or a Friday night. And, you know, this couple came and they went through it once, and I wondered if they'd come back, you know, after doing this much meditation. But they came back the second week, and they've been coming ever since. But on the second week, I came up to them and I said, "How was your sit today?" And the woman said, "You know, the darndest thing happened to me last week." She said, "I came here and I meditated, and after I meditated, all day long I felt great." You know, she said, "I don't know why, but I just felt wonderful." Well, part of this is just re-educating the body. You know, people don't realize the body has this incredible energy, this like electricity. And this is called prana in Sanskrit, and chi in Mandarin, and ki in Japanese. But there's the ancient times people have known there's like this electricity, this vital, beautiful energy. Sometimes I sit down on the cushion and it's like being washed by this beautiful energy. And even if you don't feel that it that intensely, you might feel like you're sort of buzzing, like you're sort of, you feel good. Just sitting on a cushion, on a mat, you know. So this is like re-educating the human being, you know. And the way we live, in my opinion, is not healthy, right down to the level of what we do with our bodies, you know. And so we start out with something very simple and humble. We start out with breathing, holding the spine straight, right? And then basically we begin to focus the mind on an object of attention, you know, the breath. And if you watch, you know, you begin to watch your breath, you realize your mind is like pulled this way and that way and this way and that way. And you sit down on the cushion and there's a million thoughts running through your head. You know, maybe you're thinking about the debate, Sarah Palin, you know, pops into your head. You read something online, or you're thinking about the election, or maybe you saw a movie last night. You know, all of this is like part of the collective dream, you know? Really, part of the collective dream or collective nightmare, whatever you want to call it, depending on who wins, right? But when you sit down on the cushion and you re-educate the body and you begin to watch the breath, you realize my mind is not healthy. You know, my mind is not healthy. It's distracted, fearful, angry. It's pulled this way and that way. And actually, again, you know, some of this is the result of things you did. That's true. But, you know, this is actually like socially created. You know, your mind was created by your society, by TV, the internet. This is important, this is not important, and so on and so on. If you said, I went, you told your friend, I watched the president, the vice presidential debate between Palin and Biden. And then the next day I got up and I read all the online assessments. They'd think, oh, of course, me too. But if you said, you know, I didn't watch them. I sat outside in my backyard listening to the leaves for 3 hours, you know. Again, people would say, you're an odd person. You're an odd duck, you know. But, you know, actually, you'd be so much better off sitting in your backyard listening to the leaves for 3 hours. Really. Just try it. You know, it'd be amazing what would happen. So that's kind of what we do on the cushion. You know, we sit down on the cushion. We work with the body, watch the breath, and you realize my mind is not a healthy place. My mind is like a madhouse, right? And you keep watching the breath and watching the breath, and little by little, you come down off the ceiling, right? Because most people are like hyper-tense. Really, this is, people are extremely wired all the time. And either that or they're just exhausted, right? It's like totally wired or exhausted, right? And they go back and forth. So, you know, you sit down on the cushion and maybe you meditate for 3 weeks, and all of a sudden you're going to have this experience where instead of being like in a madhouse, you suddenly, your mind is sort of resting serenely in the moment. See? Serenely in the moment. And, you know, basically, you're no longer hysterical, you know, with anxiety or fear or anger. You're no longer, you know, your cravings, you no longer suddenly want to jump up and go have a bunch of onion rings, you know. You're sitting there calmly on the cushion, and you're just returning to the breath, returning to the breath. There's no real intellectual content to this, right? But, you know, if you do that for half an hour, when you get up, you'll probably feel very refreshed. You know, very refreshed. And, eventually what's going to happen is you're going to enter this state where not only is your mind rather focused, the thoughts are not completely gone, but they're over on in one corner of your attention. The sort of center of your attention will be focused on the breath. And your mind is sort of serenely dwelling with the breath, or dwelling in the moment. And eventually, you're going to have this very pleasant feeling of like well-being or connectedness. You know, and you might not know it's connectedness, but you'll just feel very good, very safe. And you might hear something like the sound of the fan, you might just feel very reassured by that, or very, very, somehow it's pleasant to listen to, you know. And it feels like you're very reassuring somehow, I guess is the best way to put it, but very welcoming, very embracing, you know. And this is basically a different way to live, you know. All of this seems trivial, but if you add it up over time, you begin to really interact with the world in a different way. If you listen to that sound, you're in deep samadhi and you hear a sound, you begin to feel like the boundary between yourself and the sound is going away. It's like you're no longer aware of yourself. It's just the sound becomes the whole of your consciousness, you know, for a little while. And then, of course, self consciousness returns, but you could go back into the sound, and sometimes when you're sitting on the cushion, you might feel like your body has disappeared, or parts of your body are disappearing, and you're sort of floating. And after a while, you go, "Oh, I'm floating," and you start thinking, you know, again. But that's okay, because you can go, you watch the breath again, and you start floating again, and again, you have that sense of, you know, this is that sense of being safe, or the space around you is welcoming, or you feel connected to things. This is a different way of living life, you know, very different from what our society values and encourages. And my feeling is it's basically very sane, right? I mean, Most people go through their whole lives feeling like they're watching the world as though from a distance, right? You know, most people are like watching the world from a distance. And they're like possessed. It's like demonic, in my opinion, it's like demonic possession. You know, they're like possessed by these dreams that they've gotten, you know. Wealth, fabulous wealth, you know. Beautiful, you know, I drive up to northern New Jersey, and areas that used to be just fields are now filled with these houses, and these houses are so gigantic. It's unbelievable. You think, my God, you know, what could people do with all that space? No, really, I mean, some of these houses are just monstrous, right? And you, I mean, I can't even imagine having to heat them. Right? Well, why do people build such huge houses? You know, they have actually done studies of how much of these houses are ever used by the occupants. And, you know, like 60% of the house is never used. This is true. You check it out. There have been studies on this. Why do it has nothing to do with people's needs. It's all dream. It's all a fantasy. Right? It's a fantasy of safety, connectedness, happiness, but it's a fantasy. It's not real. And in my opinion, that's not how we get to connectedness, safety, etc., etc. Not that way, you know. It actually requires much less. You know, if you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, little by little, the madness in your head is going to decline a little bit, going to drain away. And that, like, right under the surface of ordinary consciousness is like an insane person, you know. But it's not that person's fault. Society creates that person. And that person is afraid, envious, angry, fearful, etc., etc. Ashamed, you name it, right? And little by little, you watch the breath, and all that stuff goes away. Now you're dwelling serenely in the moment. And you might meditate for an hour, and you might go outside and hear the wind in the leaves. And it's just like being lifted off the ground. It's so engaging and alive, right? And you feel so connected, right? This is, I think this is reality. This is reality. So you didn't have to spend $1 million, you know, for a giant house. It's right there. So you know, Zen is really like a different way of living. And it's, I think, based upon a kind of like deconditioning the mind. And it's based upon dissolving our illusions, deconditioning, dissolving our illusions, and then one by one, as those illusions go away, including the illusion of our separateness from everything else, the world is really transformed. Everything comes alive. You know, this is like a radically living world. I didn't put that very well, but you know, actually. The value system of our culture is quite unhealthy. It takes living spaces and it turns them into dead spaces. That's really true. So you know, you'll see a forest and you think, oh my God, think of all the bio activity going on in that acre of forest. You know, you've got bugs, you've got mice, you've got chipmunks, you've got squirrels, you've got hawks, you've got, I mean, cut it down, Walmart parking lot. You know, if you could, what happened to all that life? It's all gone, right? Now, you know, if we keep going until there's no forest left, it's just suburbs and Walmart, life on Earth will be unsustainable. A child could see it, right? Unsustainable. If you universalize the way we live now, life on Earth could not possibly continue. Couldn't. But the way we live now is like supported by the way we treat our bodies. It's supported by our mental world, which are insane, right? And when you sit down on a cushion and you watch your breath, you stop being insane after a while. It might take a lot of work, but you stop being so insane. You have moments of sanity. Right? And they get to be more and more and longer and longer. And you go outside and you realize everything is like my own body. And that's not a fantasy. The fantasy is that we're separate from everything. You know? And this is like a different way of life. You know, I don't know if, you know, humans will manage to overcome their illusions or not. But you can overcome your illusions, right? We really can't decide for all history, you know, how things are going to work out. But you don't have to be crazy. Right? You don't have to be. And if you said to somebody, I meditate 14 hours, between 10 and 14 hours every morning and then at night or something like that, you know, people would think you were crazy, you know? They'd think, yeah, that's crazy. But I don't think it is. You know, I think it's you know, I think, so please, you know, think about it. You know, give it some thought. And ask yourself, you know, what makes you feel better? You know, there was a guy named, I'll wrap this up, but there was a guy named Bill McKibben. And Bill McKibben conducted an experiment. He just watched television nonstop for a week, right? You know, and at the end of it, he was like ready to kill himself. But he was really saying, how does this affect people? You know, how does this affect us? You know, but on the other hand, you know, some of you have gone to our wonderful sesshin, our wonderful retreat where we do meditation for a week. At the end of that, you know, you look at people's faces and their faces are so serene. And people are so calm. And when they're not frightened or angry, people can be so compassionate, you know, so kind, and patient, and engaged, and alive. So, anyway. Uman held out his staff, and he said to the assembled monks, the staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed up the universe. What he means is that we have all been doing our meditation this morning. If you are in deep samadhi once in a while, you will notice that the sound of the fan becomes your whole consciousness. The boundary between yourself and the world disappears for a little while. And you realize a deeper connection. And all the rest just disappears, right? You say, you become the sound of the fan. You become, in this case, his walking stick, right? He says, if you are in deep samadhi and you look at my walking stick, you know, the whole universe becomes this beautiful walking stick. The boundary between yourself and the world disappears. So, you know, everything is your true self. Everything is yourself. You don't, maybe don't experience it that way, but that's a socially induced insanity. Actually, everything is one life. Sutro's verse, the staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the waters. The fish that gets its tail singed, see, that's us, right? We're fish, but we don't, for some reason, we don't stay in the water. We have to get out, and we get our tails burned, right? And there's other fish that are lying on the ground. We jump out of our natural habitat onto the shore, and we lie there for dear life, right? This is what happened to the United States this week, right? And he says, you know, don't lose heart. You know, don't give up. You have another. There's another way to live. You know, you might think I'm done for, you know. But just remember these. Sit on the cushion, straighten your back, watch your breath. You know, watch the breath. The mind returns to sanity, and suddenly everything comes alive. He says, only be carefree. See, Zen is about being carefree. You can't be carefree by actually playing the stock market. You know, if you're an investor, you know, please keep your job if you can. You know. But no matter what happens, it won't make you carefree. But being in deep samadhi, being deeply in deep Buddha mind, will make you carefree. That's what it's all about. Trust everything. Only be carefree. Why so bewildered? You know, humans make themselves sick, you know, with these dreams. But we don't have to be sick. You know, and in my opinion, by coming here today, we all made ourselves a little better.